Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. I want to start the program today in a different kind of way than usual. We're going to play an extended excerpt, a couple of them actually, of a speech that you probably heard took place yesterday, and maybe you've heard a few newsy sound bites from. It's the speech that former President Barack Obama gave in South Africa to honor the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela. He was invited there to give this year's annual Nelson Mandela Lecture, as they call it, and Obama got the honor of that invitation on the momentous occasion of celebrating Mandela's 100th birthday, if he had lived this long. So as we hear the speeches of our current president, all focused on grievance and blame and strongman self-aggrandizement and the weirdness of celebrating Putin while dissing almost everyone else in the last few days, and that weird little walk back yesterday of one word in his news conference with Putin while not really changing the meaning. Obama, by contrast, took the opportunity of his Mandela speech to take a long and complex look at the history of the last 100 years from the time of Nelson Mandela's birth until now to describe some of how we got here to this place where liberal democracy, having so recently flourished around the world, he cites a rise from after World War II through about the 90s, is now in retreat against strongman politics, and not just in the United States. So we'll play a couple of clips. The first one's about 9 minutes. I said extended excerpt. We want to give this some real stretch out time. And we'll pick it up after Obama has stated that progress has been real over the last century in terms of human rights and prosperity for many kinds of people compared to any previous time in human history. He says, thanks to the spread of democratic ideals and economic interconnectedness facilitated by technology. But then comes the but in this equation, the but and the and.
And while globalization and technology have opened up new opportunities, have driven remarkable economic growth in previously struggling parts of the world, globalization has also upended the agricultural and manufacturing sectors in many countries, has also greatly reduced the demand for certain workers, has helped weaken unions and laborers' bargaining power. It's made it easier for capital to avoid tax laws and the regulations of nation states. Can just move billions, trillions of dollars with a tap of a computer key. And the result of all these trends has been an explosion in economic inequality. It's meant that a few dozen individuals control the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of humanity. That's not an exaggeration, that's a statistic. Think about that. In many middle-income and developing countries, new wealth has just tracked the old bad deal that people got because it reinforced or even compounded existing patterns of inequality. The only difference is it created even greater opportunities for corruption on an epic scale. And for once solidly middle-class families in advanced economies like the United States, these trends have meant greater economic insecurity, especially for those who don't have specialized skills, people who were in manufacturing, people working in factories, people working on farms. In every country, just about, the disproportionate economic clout of those at the top has provided these individuals with wildly disproportionate influence on their country's political life and on its media, on what policies are pursued and whose interests end up being ignored. Now, it should be noted that this new international elite, the professional class that supports them, differs in important respects from the ruling aristocracies of old. It includes many who are self-made. It includes champions of meritocracy. And although still mostly white and male, as a group, they reflect a diversity of nationalities and ethnicities that would have not existed 100 years ago. A decent percentage consider themselves liberal in their politics, modern and cosmopolitan in their outlook, unburdened by parochialism or nationalism or overt racial prejudice or strong religious sentiment. They are equally comfortable in New York or London or Shanghai or Nairobi or Buenos Aires or Johannesburg. Many are sincere and effective in their philanthropy. Some of them count Nelson Mandela among their heroes. Some even supported Barack Obama for the presidency of the United States. And by virtue of my status as a former head of state, some of them consider me as an honorary member of the club. You know, I get invited to these fancy things, you know. They'll fly me out. But what's nevertheless true is that in their business dealings, many titans of industry and finance are increasingly detached from any single locale or nation state. They live lives more and more insulated from the struggles of ordinary people in their countries of origin. And their decisions to shut down a manufacturing plant or to try to minimize their tax bill by shifting profits to a tax haven with the help of high-priced accountants or lawyers, or their decision to take advantage of lower-cost immigrant labor, or their decision to pay a bribe, are often done without malice. It's just a rational response they consider to the demands of their balance sheets and their shareholders and competitive pressures. But too often these decisions are also made without reference to notions of human solidarity or a ground-level understanding of the consequences that will be felt by particular people in particular communities by the decisions that they're made. And from their boardrooms or retreats, global decision makers don't get a chance to see sometimes the pain in the faces of laid-off workers. Their kids don't suffer when cuts in public education and healthcare result as a consequence of a reduced tax base because of tax avoidance. They can't hear the resentment of an older tradesman when he complains that a newcomer doesn't speak his language on a job site when he once worked. They're less subject to the discomfort and the displacement that some of their countrymen may feel as globalization scrambles not only existing economic arrangements but traditional social and religious mores. Which is why, at the end of the 20th century, while some Western commentators were declaring the end of history and the inevitable triumph of liberal democracy and the virtues of the global supply chain, so many missed signs of a brewing backlash. A backlash that arrived in so many forms. It announced itself most violently with 9/11 and the emergence of transnational terrorist networks, fueled by an ideology that perverted one of the world's great religions and asserted a struggle not just between Islam and the West, but between Islam and modernity. And an ill-advised U.S. invasion of Iraq didn't help, accelerating a sectarian conflict. Russia, already humiliated by its reduced influence since the collapse of the Soviet Union, feeling threatened by democratic movements along its borders, suddenly started reasserting authoritarian control, and in some cases meddling with its neighbors. China, emboldened by its economic success, started bristling against criticism of its human rights record. It framed the promotion of universal values as nothing more than foreign meddling, imperialism under a new name. Within the United States, within the European Union, challenges to globalization first came from the left, but then came more forcefully from the right, as you started seeing populist movements, which, by the way, are often cynically funded by right-wing billionaires intent on reducing government constraints on their business interests. These movements tapped the unease that was felt by many people who lived outside of the urban cores, fears that economic security was slipping away, that their social status and privileges were eroding, that their cultural identities were being threatened by outsiders, somebody that didn't look like them or sound like them or pray as they did.
Former President Barack Obama from the Nelson Mandela Lecture yesterday in South Africa, marking the 100th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's birth. We'll play a couple of more shorter sections when Obama gets to the most direct criticism of Trump's and other strongman-style leaders' relationship to the truth. For example, he never mentions Trump by name, but his name is strongly implied as we go back to the speech for another 3 minutes.
It's tempting right now to give in to cynicism, to believe that recent shifts in global politics are too powerful to push back, that the pendulum has swung permanently. And just as people spoke about the triumph of democracy in the 90s, now you're hearing people talk about the end of democracy and the triumph of tribalism and the strong man. We have to resist that cynicism. Because we've been through darker times. We've been in lower valleys. Yes, by the end of his life, Madiba embodied the successful struggle for human rights. But that journey was not easy. It wasn't preordained. The man went to prison for almost 3 decades. He split limestone in the heat. He slept in a small cell and was repeatedly put in solitary confinement. And I remember talking to some of his former colleagues, saying how they hadn't realized when they were released just the sight of a child. The idea of holding a child, they had missed. It wasn't something available to them. For decades. And yet somehow his power actually grew during those years. And the power of his jailers diminished. Because he knew that if you stick to what's true, if you know what's in your heart, and you're willing to sacrifice for it, even in the face of overwhelming odds, then it might not happen tomorrow. It might not happen next week. It might not even happen in your lifetime. Things may go backwards for a while, but ultimately, right makes might, not the other way around. Ultimately, the better story can win out. And as strong as Madiba's spirit may have been, he would not have sustained that hope had he been alone in the struggle. Part of what buoyed him up was he knew that each year the ranks of freedom fighters were replenishing. Young men and women here in South Africa and the ANC and beyond, but also black and white and Indian from across the countryside, across the continent, around the world, who in those most difficult days would keep working on behalf of his vision. And that's what we need right now. We don't just need one leader. We don't just need one inspiration. What we badly need right now is that collective spirit.
So that was from near the end of the Obama speech in South Africa yesterday, where he tried to regenerate a spirit of hope, as a lot of people are getting cynical considering many of the things that are going on in the United States and the world today. And we're going to go back more toward the middle of the speech for one more short section, a little over 2 minutes, when Obama gets to the question of strongman style leaders' relationship to the truth and objective reality. Listen.
And I should add, for this to work, we have to actually believe in an objective reality. This is another one of these things that I didn't think I had to lecture about. You have to believe in facts. Without facts, there's no basis for cooperation. If I say this is a podium and you say this is an elephant, it's going to be hard for us to cooperate. I can find common ground for those who oppose the Paris Accords. Because, for example, they might say, well, it's not going to work. You can't get everybody to cooperate. Or they might say, it's more important for us to provide cheap energy for the poor, even if it means in the short term that there's more pollution. At least I can have a debate with them about that. And I can show them why I think clean energy is the better path, especially for poor countries, that you can leapfrog old technologies. I can't find common ground if somebody says climate change is just not happening when almost all the world's scientists tell us it is. I don't know where to start talking to you about this. If you start saying it's an elaborate hoax, I don't know what to... Where do we start? Unfortunately, too much of politics today seems to reject the very concept of objective truth. People just make stuff up. They just make stuff up. We see it in the growth of state-sponsored propaganda. We see it in internet-driven fabrications. We see it in the blurring of lines between news and entertainment. We see the utter loss of shame among political leaders where they're caught in a lie and they just double down and they lie some more. Let me say, politicians have always lied. But it used to be if you caught them lying, they'd be like, oh man. Now they just keep on lying. They just...
And that's the part you probably already heard as a soundbite in people's newscasts over the last day or so. We just gave you about 15 minutes of extended excerpts because we thought it was worth it from former President Barack Obama from the Nelson Mandela lecture yesterday in South Africa, marking the 100th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's birth. We thought you might like to hear some of that in more extended form. For its big take on history and truth and the human condition at this moment. Hope you enjoyed hearing that. We can take a few reactions on the phones if you had any while listening to that at 212-433-2└. WNYC, 212-433-9692. And with me now, Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian U.S., based in Washington. Lauren, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in contrast to Obama, and very much to the point of his speech, I want to play an exchange that aired last night between President Trump and Fox News host Tucker Carlson that you wrote about in The Guardian today regarding Putin and Angela Merkel. I think this shows the rising place of nationalism at this moment, as Obama was referring to, because Carlson doesn't ask Trump who's more on the side of right, Angela Merkel or Vladimir Putin. He asks who better represents their country's interest. Listen.
Having met with, talked to, watched carefully Angela Merkel in Germany, Vladimir Putin in Russia, who do you think, from the perspective of their countries, does a better job representing the interest, again, of their countries?
So Angela was a superstar until she allowed millions of people to come into Germany. That really hurt her badly, as you know. She was unbeatable in any election. She allowed millions of people to come in. And when they came into Germany, they passed everywhere else and they went to lots of other countries, although Hungary would not take any and a lot of people wouldn't. But what happened is it was the Great Migration. And obviously, it's hurt Angela very much. So I don't want to say who's better, who's not better, but I will say this. She's been very badly hurt by immigration.
Trump with Tucker Carlson on Fox News Channel last night. Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, my guest. Lauren, why did you choose to write about that exchange in The Guardian?
Well, I think it kind of, I mean, for me, it really symbolized this turning away from allies and turning towards, you know, sort of leaders that the U.S. has always had strained relations with, but, you know, people who the U.S. has tried to hold to account, who have, you know, not demonstrated at all times the democratic values that the U.S. Likes to promote on a world stage. So I think that question was just really sort of symbolic of that struggle, which we saw play out in, you know, in Trump's European trip, starting with that summit in Brussels with the NATO allies, and then sort of culminating in this incredible press conference with Vladimir Putin. So I chose to write about that because then it gets into, you know, the broader questions of where does the U.S. see itself? What is its role on the international stage? Are we pulling away from NATO? Are we pulling away from these sort of post-war alliances that have defined American foreign policy? And I thought it was interesting that you queued this up with the Obama speech, because I think it shows this really split screen image of two leaders who represent very, very different impulses for American foreign policy and really America on the world stage.
Yeah, and I didn't see the full Tucker Carlson interview with Trump last night, but did they also talk about the plight of the refugees themselves at all, the people fleeing ISIS and fleeing Assad's murderous dictatorship, and what Europe wants to stand for in the world in that respect, or the U.S.?
Well, I mean, that's what's interesting. You know, Trump sees this very much through the lens of immigration policy, and Trump has, you know, often sort of confused or possibly conflated immigrants and refugees. So the subject of refugees did not come up in the interview. It wasn't a discussion of why Europe is you know, facing or sort of on the receiving end of this refugee crisis. It was much more, you know, putting up walls. He defended the U.S. putting up a wall, but, you know, sort of suggested it's something that European countries should consider. This was very much in the context of, and as you saw in that clip you played, he references Hungary, which is a country that's taken a much different posture than Germany and not allowed these refugees to seek refuge in their country. And so I think, you know, historically we would seek to align the U.S. with countries like Germany and you know, this more welcoming, we are open for refugees, we're a place of refuge. But in this interview, he clearly puts us more in line with a country like Hungary, which is pretty remarkable.
And you also wrote up this exchange between Carlson and Trump. The president cast doubt on his commitment to the very basis of NATO, the so-called Article 5, which says that a military attack on any NATO nation will be considered an attack on all. This is mostly seen as a bulwark against, guess what, Russian expansionism. But here's the question by Fox News host Tucker Carlson.
Why should my son go to Montenegro to defend it from attack? Why is that?
I understand what you're saying. I've asked the same question. You know, Montenegro is a tiny country with very strong people.
Yeah, I'm not against Montenegro or Albania.
No, by the way, they're very strong people. They're very aggressive people. They may get aggressive. And congratulations, you're in World War III.
Lauren, why did you write up that particular exchange?
Moving beyond the bizarre characterization of Montenegro.
They're very aggressive people.
I think, you know, it's important to remember that actually Montenegro sent people to Afghanistan when the U.S. invoked Article 5 after the September 11th attack. So the idea, why should my son fight for Montenegro? Well, you know, somebody's sons or daughters have been fighting for the U.S. And so, I mean, I think it's just another example and a very potent one, especially to allies watching and sort of wondering what Trump is thinking and where his true alliances lie. I think that was another just revealing comment. Of course, he's, you know, made comments like this before, and going into the Brussels summit, he clearly expressed a similar sentiment. But I think, you know, this is just another distillation of how different our foreign policy is under Donald Trump.
Is there a reason they use Montenegro as an example? By the way, I'm not familiar. Is Montenegro doing something aggressive or controversial right now?
I don't think Montenegro is, I don't think we're considering, you know, them to be the reason we have World War III, as Trump suggested. I think it's just maybe a small country that they like to point to. Why should a big, big country, you know, Trump is
right.
Sort of, we know he likes size, so.
But then if you play it out, he's using that small, obscure country to say, why should we have this Article 5 pact with NATO, where we've all promised to defend any of the other NATO countries if any one of them gets attacked? So he uses Montenegro because it's obscure as an example, but then by implication, he's also saying, why should we respond if Germany is attacked? Why should we respond if France is attacked? Things like that.
I think that's definitely the concern allies have, and you know, it's certainly, you can extrapolate that to apply to any of these NATO member countries, and you know, certainly at a moment when, you know, if Russia thinks that the U.S. isn't going to respond, or if there's sort of, I mean, we saw under Obama, Russia, you know, being very aggressive in Ukraine and with Crimea. And so if there's this idea that the U.S. now might not stand up in a stronger way, I don't want to say that there wasn't criticism of the way Obama handled this. There certainly was. But I think if there's this idea that Russia may have more leverage now with the U.S., then certainly allies are worried and, mm-hmm. you know, worried about Russia aggression in Eastern Europe. This is certainly a concern.
What was the criticism of how Obama handled this that you're referring to?
So I think this has come up a lot recently in the way Republicans have responded to Donald Trump's conduct with President Vladimir Putin. So there's a criticism that Obama wasn't strong enough in his response to Russian aggression in Crimea, that he should have done more, possibly arming Ukrainian, you know, getting sort of some level of military involvement. There was a strong sentiment among, you know, American foreign policy hawks that Obama was weak. So I think I do think it's interesting then to see how Republicans are responding and sort of pointing to Obama's response and saying, well, you know, is Trump doing anything different? It's just an interesting argument. I'm not sure they exactly. I don't think these two. I think Trump standing on the world stage just days after the indictment and refusing to sort of address the Russian meddling was very stark. Obama's was part of a broader foreign policy decision. It wasn't sort of one clear moment on a stage. So these situations aren't exactly comparable, but certainly that's an argument Republicans are making.
My guest is Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian U.S. based in Washington. We have a lot of callers who want to respond in some way to the extended Obama speech excerpts that we played. Some more gushing, some more critical. Let's start with Ruth and Merrick. Ruth, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Listening to Obama, I kept thinking, this is the speech he should have given while he was president. It is a marvelous speech. Part of the problem we're in today is that we didn't hear that speech when the country needed to hear it. I was reading the book by Thomas Franks, Listen, Liberal, during the fall of 2016. Mm-hmm. And the criticism he makes of the Democrats going back to Clinton and even in the Obama administration, how they were disengaged from communities. And I've been reading David Brooks of the New York Times, and he keeps talking about, you know, community. And when Obama made the statement in the speech about how people have decisions being made for them by these faceless corporations that are not connected or disconnected from the communities where people live in, this is all true. But I think it's a little bit too late, and I would have to say, even though I am an admirer of Obama, that he should have said this much earlier. And secondly, his administration didn't do enough to act upon what he said in this wonderful speech.
Ruth, thank you so much. Victor in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Victor.
Hi. So essentially, it was, the excerpts you played were very interesting, and I have just some brief reflections on them. When he began talking about income inequality, how a few dozen people have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the human race, he got very, very close to making what might be considered almost a structural critique of capitalism, or at least a very strong critique of how it has unfolded over the past 300 to 500 years of its history. From that, he immediately pivots to talking about this kind of, you know, cosmopolitan liberal portion of the elite that, you know, idolized Mandela, supported him, and then as though to paint that as being the symbol of that elite.
Even progressive people who aren't so attached to their religion, he used that example, who are more secularized, who might have considered Mandela a hero, might have voted for him, Obama, for president, if they're part of this international elite who feels so comfortable in different cities in the world, a little detached from their nations or communities, then maybe they're part of the problem, he was suggesting. But then went on from there to say, but the reaction to that is this really destructive nationalism like we might associate with Donald Trump, though he didn't mention Trump by name. I mean, he really lays out a paradox in there. I'm not sure if he solved it.
Yeah, precisely. And then in the way he uses history, he doesn't really engage with the, you know, legacy of colonialism. He talks about, Nelson Mandela, and he says while he was in prison, he somehow became more powerful.
Well, he did, just to be fair, he did refer to the legacy of colonialism earlier in the speech before the excerpt we played. So I just want to give him that credit for at least bringing it up.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and that's part of why I thank you for playing the excerpt, because I'm going to go and listen to the entire speech. That's fine. But I was going to say that the name of that somehow is named Winnie Mandela. And, you know, if you look at the history of South Africa during that time, it was really her going out into the street in kind of a vacuum, which was created by a lot of the male leaders being imprisoned and exiled and killed. And, you know, she went out there and she politicked actively as the wife of Nelson Mandela. And, you know, after, you know, she gained a level of prominence, it is thought that many members of the apartheid government saw her as being more radical than somebody they would prefer, and then maybe began to, you know, look at negotiating with Nelson Mandela.
Victor, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Waseem in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Waseem.
Hey, Brian, this was great. Thank you so much, because I think the speech needed a much wider audience, and I hope and I eventually it will get that. But the what stood out in the first 7 minutes that you played was his concept and notion of human solidarity that seems to be missing in a lot of decision making at the highest levels in various corporations, the decision makers who are very influential, of course, and make big impact. But that portion, that gap is really a source of a lot of trouble, what as we are seeing today, and also plays into the politics of the day. So I thought that was a key notion to our message to take away. I just wanted to point out that, you know.
Wasim, thank you so much. Sandra in Brooklyn wants to bring this back to the Montenegro reference in the Trump and Tucker Carlson exchange. Sandra, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to make a comment when you were talking to your guest earlier, and you discussed the why would Trump talk about Montenegro. Now, I'm a New Yorker. I was born and raised here, and I have a very cynical opinion of Trump, as one might expect. But Montenegro used to be part of former Yugoslavia, and Trump's wife was born in Slovenia, was part of Yugoslavia. She was born when it was a country called Yugoslavia. And you know, they're very familiar with each other, all these republics. And I remember my family was Yugoslav, Serbian. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everybody had comments to make over the other republics. Now, Montenegro has coastline just like Croatia does. And they're a small, remote country, yes. They don't pose any threat to anybody, as you guys talked about. But they have coastline, which, in my opinion, and this is where I'm cynical, I feel like whatever Trump talks about, he's only thinking about his self-interest, where he can plop another hotel, where he can buy up real estate, where he can, you know, maybe be in alliance with somebody like Putin to go in together. And, you know, you take over a small country like that, you start putting fears in the American public's ears, like this country is very dangerous. We're going to go in, we're going to take it over. And guess what? But lo and behold, you have a new Trump hotel there. Maybe not now, but later on after he's not president anymore.
Interesting, Sandra. Thank you very much. Or Lauren Gambino from The Guardian. I admit my ignorance on Montenegro and Melania's country of origin, Slovenia. Who knows what Trump may have heard around the dinner table? Like, maybe, you know, with all the different rivalries in the Balkans, maybe Montenegro did something that Slovenia considers aggressive. Maybe that really was aggressive, and he heard that somewhere over the air. So, we're going to go in and defend Montenegro. I have no idea. But since Sandra referenced, you know, sort of the geographical context of that, who knows, right?
Yeah, and I have to admit, I don't actually know the reason they brought it up, but it was brought up by Tucker Carlson in the way he posed the question. It kind of sounded like, why should I send my son to some? And he was sort of, I mean, this is just what I'm interpreting, but it sounded like to some obscure place to defend. Yeah.
And that's fair also to say that it was Tucker Carlson, not Trump, who first brought up Montenegro as the example. Before you go, you did a fact check in the same article today on another thing Trump said in that interview about NATO, that member countries are now raising more money for NATO, which he's been pushing them to do. You wrote, they're not really raising money for NATO. Explain.
So Trump has sort of repeatedly mischaracterized how NATO works. And Trump deserves credit for you know, sort of putting the pressure on and making sure they do commit to this agreement. But the agreement is that member countries will spend 2% of their country's national GDP on their own defense. So by spending more on their own defense, that, you know, in turn helps NATO. The U.S. obviously spends more than the NATO countries were quite big. So therefore, you know, by comparison, we do spend more. But part of this agreement reached in 2014 was that NATO countries would spend 2% of their GDP on their own defense by 2024. And that isn't exactly the same thing as sort of raising tons of money for the alliance itself.
For NATO.
You know,
right. It's on their own defense. So if all the NATO countries get to that 2% of GDP for their national defense that they're supposed to spend, and I think this really gets lost in the conversation, would that allow American taxpayers to spend less on our military? Because that's where Trump lands with his rhetoric on this, is that the U.S. taxpayer is getting milked for the defense of Germany while it imports energy from Russia on Montenegro, and who cares about Montenegro? But if they all got to 2%, would we spend any less on our military?
I mean, that's a question that would ultimately come back to Congress, who sets the budget, but probably not. I mean, it's quite unpopular, I think, especially among Republicans, to spend less on the U.S. military. I don't know if the equation would exactly work out that way, that suddenly we'd have, right, you know, opportunity to spend money elsewhere. So I think, I mean, it depends on who's in control
in power
of Congress.
That's a fair point. Certainly in Trump's budget, there's no contingency that says if, as the NATO countries spend more on their defense, which he says they've promised to do, that the U.S. is going to cut back. If anything, one of the central tenets of the Trump administration is that we've been spending too little on defense in this country and to spend more and more and more. So to say that at the same time as saying they're burdening the American taxpayer with our need to spend on defense, it just doesn't hang together. And I just never hear that disconnect referenced. I thank Lauren Gambino, political correspondent in Washington for The Guardian US. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.